Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
For 27 years, he's been behind bars. Today, he was freed on bail pending his appeal for a murder he says he didn't commit. Dressed smartly and with a wide smile, 44-year-old Stephen Downing emerged from Little Hay Prison in Cambridgeshire to meet the waiting press.
I'd like to thank all the public for their support and for the media for everything that they've done. Been very, very pleased with it.
Stephen Downing there, walking out of prison in 2001. After 8 years of campaigning, led by Matlock Mercury editor Don Hale, Stephen was released on bail, pending an appeal, for his conviction of the murder of Wendy Saul in 1973. He'd been inside for 27 years. The appeal was finally held after a remarkable false start. The prosecution barrister declared, on the very first day of the appeal, he'd booked a family holiday the very next day, and he'd have to take a pause for a fortnight. Oops, sorry. But hey, what's 2 weeks when you've been in prison for nearly three decades?
I certainly remember the front page of that day because we obviously went with a huge headline for it. And I think the headline just said cleared. And then they were keen to get my byline quite high up. And then it said Matt Barlow at court, but it almost looked like it said cleared Matt Barlow.
Those present in the media throng at the court in London included Matlock Mercury journalist Matt Barlow. What's your connection with Don Hale and the Matlock Mercury?
It was my first proper job, really, in journalism, was working at the Matlock Mercury when all of this was happening, as it was all coming to a head, when Downing got released. And it was just a real eye-opening time.
Getting his first professional job at the climax of an eight-year-long massive mistrial case, spearheaded by his editor and new boss, was an enormous stroke of luck for young reporter Matt Barlow.
Going into 2002, I covered the appeal hearing down in London, which for me at the time was a really big deal. Don had left the Matlock Mercury at that point, and I was given the job of covering it as the reporter on the day down at the Old Bailey, which was just incredibly exciting.
And so tell me about going down to cover the appeal.
Well, it was quite low budget in a way. And that's the thing that sort of really struck me, because the hotel that I was booked in to stay was probably one of the cheapest ones that we could find there. It was really a rough old place. I think some of the other guests might have been paying by the hour, but it was just kind of just a bit rude.
Case crossed there.
It was certainly sort of down at heel. I went down on the train. It was in the middle of winter. And one of the things that struck me was the kind of whole wintry feel of that. And certainly from the quietness of covering the case and the darkness of the Old Bailey, this sort of atmospheric, sort of dark wooden low ceilings there, to going outside and just being hit by all the flashes of the photography as those doors opened. And everyone was like, you know, kind of rabbits staring into car headlights, sort of early evening, I think, as we did walk out of the court. I know it did start in the morning, but it was all wrapped up within the day.
The famous steps of the Court of Appeal have seen it all before, but never such a walk to freedom that began so many years ago. For the first time since he was arrested at the age of 17, Stephen Downing could face the world tonight as an innocent man.
I'd just like to thank everyone. They've been absolutely fantastic.
What's your view of the Derbyshire Police now, Stephen? What's your view of the Derbyshire Police now, Stephen?
I've got no qualms with the Derbyshire Police. They're a different force altogether. What did
you
say?
Can I get a bit of a level for you?
Patrick McLaughlin, Member of Parliament for Derbyshire Dales. I'd never been to a court of appeal before to sit and watch a case, so it was outside the Strand where you know you often see these cases come forward. But I don't think I've been back since, actually. If my memory turns me right, the sort of the Crown Prosecution Service accepted quite a bit of what the defence lawyer was saying for Stephen, or the lawyer that was putting Stephen's case, and that's when the I have got it written down somewhere. I'm afraid because I hadn't seen anything like that before. And they decided that the case was basically an unsafe case. It was very matter-of-fact, and I you know, as to why they said that the case was unsafe. And it is important to remember that that's what the court decided. They did not decide of innocence, actually. They said it was an unsafe conviction and therefore should not stand. You know, when you get... And in a way, after such a long period of time, it was quite revealing that it had taken so long.
I'm sure there will be...
Stephen, who do you blame for what happened to you?
That's all in the past. Let's forget it.
What about you?
Thank
you. What he was released on was the police procedure at the time that had been so... wayward, because he hadn't been given access to a solicitor or legal representation. He didn't have his full rights. So, you know, in terms of the depth of the case, in some ways, it was a kind of by that point, it was a kind of rubber stamping exercise. And even to this day, because of that and because of his release, in a way, Stephen's case hasn't been sort of fully aired, you know, since then in court.
I'm Neil Mackay, and we're in the graveyard in Bacol.
Neil wrote a factual drama for the BBC, in denial of murder, about the case in the early 2000s.
So early on in the research I did, I spoke to the Reverend Edmund Urquhart, who was still the vicar of Bacol at the time I met him, and he had been the vicar at the time, and He rather disputed the fact that this was Bakewell was a town that sort of had its secrets or had its villains lurking in the bushes trying to suppress the truth about this story. He rather disputed that, and he put me in touch with various people who took a different view of that, basically.
And so was the picture that you came to a kind of very different picture than the one that you'd originally set out to investigate, the one that Don Hale had been proposing?
I'd say it was more complex, I would say, the picture that I got. So that at the time I was researching, Stephen's release from prison was becoming more and more imminent. And then I attended Stephen's appeal hearing at the Royal Courts of Justice. And obviously I read the appeal court's judgment. So clearly they went through the evidence carefully, bit by bit, and took the various pieces of evidence which had been used to convict Stephen. They basically found that the conviction was unsafe for various reasons, principal one being that he wasn't cautioned at the correct time. He should have been cautioned. Got to remember, this was all pre-PACE, the guidelines the police have now, Police and Criminal Evidence Act. Police investigations happened at that time then under a thing called the judge's rules, and that was a kind of code that had been created for the police. And under the judge's rules, a suspect has to be cautioned at a certain time in a certain way. Now it's much more stringent under PACE, you know, and the fact the police caution is a more complex piece of wording and all the rest of it. Mm. So clearly he was not cautioned properly, Stephen, and there were question marks about the blood on him. Prosecution alleged that blood was because he attacked Wendy, but the rebuttal to that, he said that he tried to help her, and that's how he got the blood on him and so on. So bit by bit, the grounds for conviction were found to be unsafe. But at the end of that judgment, the appeal court judges, and anybody can read this, it's on their document, they didn't pass any comment on his guilt one way or the other. They simply said that the conviction was unsafe, and they said that a particular feature of the case was that when Stephen was arrested, he had admitted to sexually assaulting Wendy Sewell and also the attack which resulted in her murder. Two separate things. And it wasn't too long before he retracted the admission of murder, confession to murder, should I say. Mm. But it was some considerable time after that before he retracted the confession of sexual assault. So if you read the judge's summing up where the conviction is quashed, they make a point of saying that it seemed an oddity that if he'd not sexually assaulted Wendy Sewell, why would he not have retracted that confession at the same time he retracted the confession to murder? And I pass no comment or judgment on that. It's not for me to pass any judgment whatsoever. Nonetheless, that's what the judges said. So there's no question that it was an unsafe conviction, and there's no question that, you know, we now don't know who was responsible for what happened.
Because it was quite detailed and graphic, the confession about sexual assault.
Yes, if you read, I've read the original trial transcript and the statements and so on, and you know, clearly it was a ferocious sexual assault, extremely violent, and must have been utterly horrific for Wendy, the victim. You know, she didn't die immediately. She was hit about the head and staggered, and then tried to get up, and must have wondered what on earth was happening. Then she lost consciousness, and then was taken to hospital, and, you know, she didn't die immediately.
I've got a copy of the appeal court transcript. It does not make comfortable reading.
Had the admissibility of the confession been challenged and impropriety by police officers alleged, it would have had a profound effect upon this trial. Confessions are excluded on the ground that they are not obtained voluntarily, even if they are admitted. There remains the question whether they contain reliable admissions. In our judgment, had the matter been raised with the judge, these confessions may well have been excluded by him. Even if they had been admitted, the judge would have alerted to circumstances which may have rendered them unreliable. The judge's rules and now the procedures under the Police and Criminal Evidence Act 1984 were promulgated to ensure fairness. In the absence of an investigation of the facts, with the rules in mind, the jury may well, in a case such as the present, have been unaware of the real risks arising from the non-observance of the rules and the proper procedures. Had the matter been challenged, the jury's eyes would have been opened as to the risks.
We've talked about this before because we read the partial trial transcript when the judge was going, has it been obtained under duress? But the defence never did it. They never said, this is wrong.
The court is aware of the unlikelihood, on the face of it, of someone sexually assaulting a badly injured woman, as the appellant admits he did, unless it was he who previously disabled her with sexual assault in mind. The court is also aware of the confessions made to several doctors in circumstances very different from those in the police station.
During his 27 years in prison, Stephen had allegedly repeated the admission that he had sexually assaulted but hadn't murdered Wendy to various medical staff.
The presence of the appellant near the scene and the nature of the weapon must also be borne in mind. It is not, however, for this court to speculate as to what might have happened had the fundamental defect, which we find to have existed in the conduct of this trial, not been present. As Lord Bingham had recently underlined in R.V. Pendleton 2002-1 W.R. paragraph 19, the question for it, in brackets, the Courts of Appeal, consideration is whether the conviction is safe and not whether the accused is guilty.
It's not a question of innocence or guilt, it's the safety of the conviction.
In the somewhat bizarre circumstances of this case, we expressly do not address ourselves to the latter question. As to the confessions, if they are unreliable, the conviction is unsafe. The court is not considering new material, but for the first time in a court material existing at the time of the trial has been thoroughly investigated and analysed. The safety of this conviction depends on the reliability of confessions made to the police on the 12th of September 1973. The court cannot be sure that the confessions were reliable. It follows that the conviction is unsafe.
It's not to do with new evidence, it's just to do with the confession.
We do not speculate as to what might have happened if the defence had been conducted in a different way. For the reasons we have given, this appeal is allowed and the conviction is quashed. Lord Justice Pill, are there any applications?
Because I remember finding out that she'd been sexually assaulted, and there were some notes somewhere about that perhaps, you know, her clothes had been removed and things. And I remember saying, oh, well, who's done it then if it wasn't Stephen? And I remember sort of saying to Don, My name's Jackie Dunn. I used to work as a junior reporter at the Matlock Mercury. I just thought, in a way, her as a victim was overlooked in the lot of things. And I mean, obviously, we were looking at it from the point of view of his conviction, and I sort of pointed out that, you know, she wasn't a person.
She wasn't a thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Kind of matter-of-fact descriptions of her. And like, well, she did this, she did that, she was this person, and that's it. And no sort of, I don't know, a bit of humanity about her had been lost, you know.
Mm. It's easy to forget that at the centre and at the start of this story is the brutal murder of a woman, of Wendy Saul. She was taking a stroll in a country graveyard during her lunch break on a sunny day in a picturesque Derbyshire town in 1973, nearly 30 years before all this media attention, legal battles and publicity. But by this point, in 2002, the coverage is focused on Stephen, the campaign to free him, and the miscarriage of justice that had seen him inside for so very long. And for some, he was labelled the second victim of the crime. And as Stephen became centre stage, Wendy, the real, real victim, seemed to slowly slip out of sight, as women often do.
My name's Moira Black and I work in Bloomers at Bakewell, one of the pudding shops. Well, I remember when it happened, and I remember the editor of the Mercury, Don Hale, investigating the case. It took him, I think, 7 or 8 years, but he finally got Stephen Downing released because it was a sort of an unsafe. And so after 27 years, he was released.
I can remember there being a bit of a party when he was released. But this is what I'm talking about. It was quite sort of low budget and kind of quite small town, because the party that they had initially when he was released was in a small rural pub called the Cock and Pullet up in Foolow, which was just the kind of middle of nowhere, real oldie-worldie pub that in one of the back rooms of here. This was the first time that Downing was released.
So who organised that?
I don't know, to be honest. I think it was Stephen's family did.
Okay.
And a lot of the staff, although there weren't many of us working at the newspaper, there was a good chunk of the staff went to that. And there was, you know, a bit of a buffet. And like I say, it was in the back room of this pub. That was when he was initially released. And there had been press conferences in higher profile places like the George at Hathersage, which is quite an upmarket pub. That's where all the kind of world's sort of media, well, sort of national media went to. But this was more a sort of select type family and friends type gathering this was.
After his release from prison, Stephen returned to his family home and his hometown of Bakewell in Derbyshire. He still lives there now. Don recorded his research and investigation in a book under the understandably controversial title of Town Without Pity.
I don't believe it was Stephen Downing, and there's lots of rumours which I can't say whether they're right or wrong, but I think there was a lot of cover-ups. I'm convinced there was a lot of cover-ups, but you know, Stephen Downing still gets blamed for it in Bakewell, the Town Without Pity.
Do you think, because that's really harsh, isn't it? But do you think it's very true.
I think it's very true about the people in Bakewell, you see. Yeah. So, but they still believe it was him.
It must be quite hard for him to still be here with that hanging over.
It must be. But his family were here, you see, so that's where he came home to. And then obviously went back to prison. And he wouldn't. And people have asked him, why didn't you say you'd done it? You could have been out after 15 years.
45, something, yeah. Didn't they?
He said, well, why would I admit to something I hadn't done? And he never did. So.
Do you think still people are still prejudiced against him now?
Oh, I think so, yes. Oh, yes. I don't think he's welcome at all. I think people just accept that he lives here now, but they don't befriend him or anything.
Oh.
Terrible.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
Yeah. Stephen had, of course, a lot of compensation, which I'm told there's not much of it around now. And what he's done with it, I'm not quite sure. My name's David G. I was a member of the Derbyshire Police for just over 30 years, 32 years, actually. But he certainly did try to rebuild himself, there's no question, in a sort of reputable profession with... I don't know what success he's had on that, but he certainly lives his life close to his sister and is still amongst the community.
There was a big event when Stephen came back to Bakewell. Were you there then?
I did, yes. I think I went up on the Friday night or something to a sort of a celebration for his release. And that's the first time I met Stephen. I'd not seen him in prison or anything like that. And, you know, I met him and sort of wished him well for the future, because it was obviously going to be a big change in his life. Because one of the things, you know, that became apparent to me as a result of seeing him, and I did actually remember talking to David Blunkett about this, was if you're down for release, you're prepared for release. If all of a sudden the court tells you are being released because of an unsafe conviction, a lot of that preparation, which would have gone forward even in those days on a prison release, has not been done. So, you know, one day he's in prison, the next day he's a free man.
Back in Bakewell,
yes.
I mean, when it was coming towards the end, it was obvious that we were going to get the decision to quash the conviction. A lot of the nationals were chasing for exclusives with the family and... you know, Stephen himself, etc. I mean, I set up one or two deals with him, with the Mail and other groups, to try and get the family some recompense, basically. Because I didn't know whether you're going to get any compensation or what on this, when he could have just come out and that was it. So quite a lot of people come out and they get no compensation.
At the end of the campaign, the Downings, through Ray and through Don's media contacts, negotiated an exclusive deal with a national paper and reporter Nick Pryor to cover their story.
Nick was the guy that was at the prison when he was finally released.
I was going to say, was that pre-arranged or was that kind of...
Yeah.
I mean, I think in the drama thing, it implies that it's kind of, you know...
Yeah,
like
it was kind of
cut out the picture.
Well, I was. And that was the unfortunate thing, in a way, because after doing all the work with particularly with the Mail on Sunday and that, and setting up the deal and giving the access and et cetera, when it came to the crunch... when he was released, the Mail on Sunday had set up this exclusive thing with the family, barred them from talking to me, came out like a rabbit in the headlights, and was put in a car and taken to a hotel. and didn't, you know, nobody saw them for 24 hours sort of thing.
So you didn't see him the moment he was released?
No. I was,
oh, that
must
have felt awful. How did that feel?
Well, yeah, very surprising, really. We didn't know exactly when or when where he would be released from or whatever. We presumed it would be that day, and of course the Mail were in touch with everybody, and he was just turfed out of the cell with his black bin liner, and Nick shouted, "No, you know, yeah," said a couple of words, and then banged away. You see, so they did their interview at the hotel with him, all ready for the Sunday papers, etc. And then he was taken home, and he's kept with minders at home. You see, with the family and everything else. And I thought, right, okay, next day I'm going to see Stephen. You know, I went round to the house. And small sort of terraced house, absolutely packed with hundreds of cameras and journalists and everything else, all packed around the house. Television crew from all over the world's there. And he's banged up inside, you know, with the Mail on Sunday crew. So I knocked on the door, and, you know, the guys, well, I knew them all anyway, quite. And he says, "Oh, no, I don't think so." I said, "Yeah, I do think so." And just pushed my way in. And I spoke to him, and, yeah, he sort of shook my hand, Stephen, and... whatever, and but he couldn't really, he's still under restrictions not to say too much to me in case I reported it. And I just said, "Bollocks, you know, after what I've done for you, so the least you can do is give me a few quotes and that." And so I went back and did my sort of exclusive and got it out before them, really. But it was all sort of taken away, and for the next, I don't know, a few months, it was like that, very difficult with things they'd done, and they set up deals with like TV people, you know, to come and interview him and things like that. I mean, the family got money out of it, I'm sure. Yeah. You know, I got nothing out of it. But I did feel very much pushed out of the whole picture. And I was suddenly the forgotten person. No, I wasn't in it for the limelight or the fame or whatever. I was pleased in what had happened. But it seemed such a thing. And
so
it seemed,
you led this? It was your work that had made this happen?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And the strange thing was that Stephen was quite sort of going along with all this, really, in terms of, didn't sort of argue, was doing whatever he was told to do, really. Never really got any thanks from him particularly for it, in terms of realising the effort gone. And the family were almost ignoring me as well, really, which I found difficult to take after all the desperation that we'd had over the years. Because, you know, 8 years is a long time. And I felt like I was almost part of the family, really. Stephen was the almost the odd one out, because he was a fixture in a distance. But when they're all together, I thought, well, they'd be more than welcoming to have me on board, really. And it was a bit of a difficult relationship, you know, where Ray and that were saying, "Well, I'm sorry, but I can't really discuss it with you," and things like this. And I've got his lad out of prison. And, yeah. I mean, it was very strange, the whole thing. I mean, it was, you know, when we had parades and signatures, 15,000 signatures, you know, it's more than Batewell's population, you know.
Wow.
I mean, it was just quite bizarre, really. I don't know. It's hard to put sort of words to it, really. I mean, I wasn't bitter. I'm not bitter now. I wish him all the best, whatever he does. And but I thought, well, okay, if that's what they want to do, I'll keep away, really. And I said, I never went back to the house again. And that's why I'm always a bit reluctant to sort of, you know, get involved with anything that comes up now with him, or has come up. And so it was all a little bit,
a little bit
awkward. But he was being fleeced by these people. And he got that many get-rich-quick scheme people in touch with him about buying this, doing that. He ended up with about 3 cars, I think. And, you know, he learned to drive in a rush, and he was going to be a photographer. He was going to be... run a restaurant, he was going to do all sorts of things, you know, and not much was likely, really, because he got no experience, really.
Yeah. Series researcher Pippa Godfrey came with me to Bakewell. What did the woman at the museum say to you?
She said...
This is the Bakewell Museum.
Yeah, she didn't want to talk about it, but she said it was terrible when he was let out, because suddenly no one knew who'd done it, and people were accusing each other, left, right and centre... Wives accusing husbands, children accusing fathers. There was a man who had to leave his business. It was effectively run out of town. But she did say that suddenly everyone had it in for everybody and used it as an excuse. That's one of the things she said. They used it as an excuse to get back at people they didn't like.
The next task was to try and identify the real killer of Wendy Saul. Motivation seemed to be divided between those like Don and the Downings, who wanted to highlight police failures and clear Stephen's name, and others who wanted to get justice for Wendy. Almost immediately, Derbyshire Police launched Operation Noble, a reinvestigation of the murder. Tony Blockley was part of the investigative team, which was led by David G.
I was the head of crime in the police force at the rank of Detective Chief Superintendent. He was acquitted on the grounds of the police didn't apply the caution properly, and there was some challenge to the forensic conclusions.
If Stephen hadn't beaten Wendy to death with a pickaxe handle, someone else had.
So, of course, nothing we could do about the caution not being administered properly. And again, if it happened today, it'd be totally different, because Stephen would be represented by a solicitor anyway immediately, and the police would get him one. It's moved to that stage now, thank goodness. But the forensic side of it, we were lucky that we'd still got the murder weapon. We also had Stephen's clothing.
Because that was given back to the parents, was it?
It was, and yeah. The parents gave it back to me. Or us, should I say. And we had it re-examined. And the conclusion of Jim Fraser within the public report again.
And he's a forensic scientist. He is an
Edinburgh now, I think. He is an acknowledged blood spattering expert. Mm. And again, this is rare. He came out with a definitive conclusion that the blood spattering was consistent with Wendy having been battered to death by the wearer.
So the Stephen's clothes.
Yep, that's in the public facing document. Yeah. That's not me revealing.
No,
it's always there. So you don't really get that very often.
No, because I spoke to John Wright at Derby,
yep.
And he was talking about how basically. Blood, you know, blood spatter, a lot of forensic stuff, said, here are some stories that might be possible, rather than give the definitive. But this was
absolutely definitive in his statement. So that was, again, for us, because, of course, we were looking at the time, as the case grew, and the final analysis, with the liaison with the local Crown Prosecution Service, the law had changed recently in terms of double jeopardy. Which means that a person previously acquitted for an offence of this type could not be retried, and the law changed. So we were that was one of our options to actually go down that line.
So my name is Tony Blockley, the head of policing at the University of Derby. When I retired, I was the chief superintendent or the head of crime. I had responsibility for all crime in and around Derbyshire, and my kind of specialism, if you like, is around homicide and serious crime investigation.
The police used Don's investigation and his theories, as he'd laid out in Town Without Pity, as a template for Operation Noble.
The content of the book was the appeal and the investigation and what Don had done over the many years that he'd been supporting Stephen. And as a consequence of his release, of Stephen's release, Derbyshire Constabulary were asked to do a reinvestigation, which would be expected practice, into the circumstances of Wendy's death, and to establish, because Don was making some very strong claims in his book, and the purpose behind the investigation was to establish who had killed Wendy, if indeed that could be deduced from the evidence. So what we did, there was a number of investigators part of it. I was part of that investigation team. We investigated the death on the basis of the book, if that makes sense. So the book almost became the script of the investigation. And part of that was because there was so much evidence within the book that Don had talked about. Bearing in mind that this is 30 years, this was, you know, at that time it was 30 years ago. So to reinvestigate the offence would have had very limited outcomes. But part of the reinvestigation was to establish what had happened, the veracity of Don's claims within the book, and therefore that would, in sort of logical terms, that would lead us to understanding who had killed Wendy or been responsible for her death.
So following the kind of lines of inquiry that Don had laid out in his book Town Without Pity, you re-interviewed
people that he'd mentioned yes. as witnesses at ones that were still alive, I guess.
Yes.
Because one of the issues about a story that is a case that is so old that it gets less and less people.
Yes, although I think he named, and again, forgive me, I think this is off the top of my head, he named about 23 different people in the book. I think 23 was roughly around that number. And quite a few of them were still alive.
Okay.
So it was an interesting process. So as you would in a normal investigation, so if you're investigating a normal homicide, what you would expect to see is that there are significant people within that investigation who you want to trace and identify, and the terminology is to eliminate in terms of taking them out of their suspicion, if you like. So what you might say is that we've seen a person that was near the scene of the crime at the time of the incident. We need to trace and identify that person, or trace and interview that person, and then eliminate them from the inquiry. So you're not wasting time still investigating them. And that's often quite a complex process. It can be the fact that you've got DNA, or they don't match the description, they've got an alibi, and perhaps it might not be a wife or a girlfriend, it's a non-familial alibi, or there's other supporting evidence. So you can say with a degree of certainty they are not involved, and you can evidence that process as to why they're not involved. So that's what we adopted. We adopted that same strategy in terms of investigating the people that were named in Don's book. Now, Don didn't name them specifically. He gave them Mr. Orange and Mr. Red and Mr. Blue. So it was very sort of Pulp Fiction-y in terms of that, in terms of what that read like. But he made some, he made the claims, and when you read it at face value, there were some very strong claims in that book, and that's what Don had produced, and obviously we then investigated the complete book. So in an investigation, what would normally happen is if you've got a statement of somebody, a witness statement, you then, because in a witness statement, everything is a fact. So I was on, I was on Agard Street, I was in the University of Derby, I was with Lucy, we were in the room 307. Each aspect, each of those particular points needs investigation to support whether it's right or not. So let's see, was Lucy in the building? Have we got CCTV footage of her? Yes, she was. Were they in room 307? What can we do to find out if they were in room 307? And that kind of thing. So each line was gone through and actions were created. And I don't know the full statistics. I think there was something like 2,000 odd different statements were taken, and I would imagine at its height, there was probably about 30 officers working on it.
The son came over from Canada.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because again, in one of the allegations of the son could have done it and all this business.
And
really? Not the son could have done it, but the son could have been involved. There's all this stuff thrown in, and we had to track them down as best we could to eliminate.
It's been quite an emotional journey for him.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And for the people who were named, stuff attributed to them, which they then not just said they didn't do, they vehemently denied it.
Was John Marshall ever rumoured to have done it?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And there are people with the loosest of connections to Wendy who became, inverted commas, potential suspects. But they weren't really. But we had to, these assertions had been made, and we had to actually confirm or deny them. And if you read the someone reads a bullet report, they'll see that.
So what were the most surprising things for you during the reinvestigation?
Well, the candour of the Downing family and my relationship with them was, I expected, because I didn't know them at all, I expected some hostility, but not a bit of it. In fact, the contrary. It was first name basis. And I had a really close relationship throughout the whole reinvestigation with them. Ray would say things to me. Oh, you'll never guess, Mr. G. Guess what? Stephen admitted it to me yesterday. And, oh, did he? Yeah, yeah. We went. We were in Chesterfield at this apartment, this flat he was moving into. And I said, oh, did he? He said, yeah. So would you make a statement, right? Yeah, fine. And what? Made a statement.
He made a statement that Stephen admitted to doing, killing Wendy.
Absolutely.
What?
That's in the file. That's in the file. So that was the relationship we had. And
so what did you do with that? I mean,
well, he didn't do anything. He just told us.
And what did you have to? Well, obviously, you were investigating that because you were investigating.
No, we wanted to at the end of the whole process. We wanted to interview Stephen under caution. Right. Of course, Stephen, as a right, didn't choose not to take that option. That's up to him. But so there were things like that. The recollection of people was amazing to me. The backstory was fascinating.
Can you talk about the intimate
nature of who knows what's going on in Bakel, who knows who, who's seeing who, and it was opening up a can of worms, if you like, and the polarisation of views, if you like. Oh, Stephen Downing is guilty. Stephen Downing is definitely not guilty. He was fitted up by the police and all the rest of it. Allegations about Ray's behaviour.
Sexual.
Yeah, yeah.
In fact, he was convicted, wasn't he, yeah, years later?
He was, and that came out during the investigation. The pressure on us then was, first of all, to ensure the safety of any victim or potential victim, whilst at the same time not being potentially being accused of a witch hunt against the Downing family.
And what were the results of your investigations?
So the results. So as part of the work that Don did, he made a number of claims in the book.
Yes, because tell us about the suspects and the investigations into those.
Okay,
claims,
so right. The suspects. So we identified as many suspects, and there were. And again, I can't remember exactly how many were still alive, but there was a substantial number still alive. So we did the investigation into those suspects, and wherever we could, we traced them, we identified them, and we went through this process of eliminating them through various inquiries.
But the police quickly found what they felt were problems with the case and the narrative as reported by Don and in the book.
And in actual fact, the reality was, of all the people that were named in Don's book, every single one was deemed not suspicious or not part of the responsible for Wendy's death, which left nobody in terms of Don's claims.
Are there holes in Don's theories in Town Without Pity?
Well, shall we say things that couldn't be validated, assertions and allegations, whatever. And it's fair to say that there were significant disparities from our perspective as to what was actually written. Of course, the book was resulted in. A large part of the reinvestigation, because these were allegations about people. In the end, I think a lot of people like to think it was honourable and just to address this alleged miscarriage of justice, but whether certain things were judgment was clouded because of that, because it became, again, the cognitive bias. This is a truth. We will then only search for stuff that points to that as a truth.
But I suppose in terms of Don's role in the getting rid of the in-denial clause, and that seems like quite an important achievement.
Don has achieved a lot of things out of this. We're still talking about it. Whether he or whether we, the Derbyshire Police, have provided a definitive answer, I guess not. And we were always behind the eight ball in the sense that it was 30 years after it happened that we started to reinvestigate. Well, that has its own difficulties. However, I'm comfortable that there was sufficient validation of facts in the ensuing report that justify the comment made by Bob Wood, that there remains one suspect, and we haven't been able to speak to him.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A brutal murder. A wrongful conviction. A 27-year fight for justice. Read the full story that inspired this podcast. In Murder in the Graveyard, investigative journalist Don Hale tells the story of his relentless fight to overturn the longest miscarriage of justice the UK has ever seen. Delve deeper into the case that shocked the nation. Murder in the Graveyard. Available now in paperback, ebook, and audio narrated by author Don Hale himself.
So I've just been chatting to Matt, my editor, about how it's going, and I'm feeling very guilty. It's how it's going. I'm feeling very much like I'm getting a lot of people. A lot of people have told me off the record. No one will tell me on the record, but a lot of people are absolutely 100% certain that Stephen Downing killed Wendy. But you know, no trial by podcast. And a lot of people have told me that they think that Don's book is a tissue of lies, that it's made up. Don is a fantasist, quote one person. That he never did half the interviews he claims to have done. And it's a kind of, yeah, fabrication. And I feel incredibly like I'm betraying Don. It feels bad talking behind his back. But what I need to do is I need to get together all the suggestions I've had from other people and go and talk, put them to Don and see what he has to say about the matter. It won't be the first time his work's been criticised or rubbished by many, many people. So I need to go and give him a chance to answer the criticisms and accusations that have been levelled at him. So I think it's back to Wales.
Who's slagging me off then?
What do you think of that operation, Operation Noble?
Well, it was pretty pathetic, to be honest. They knew right from day one, when Stephen agreed to take part in this, that he wasn't prepared to take an interview under caution, because he'd just come out of jail after 28 years. There was no new evidence. You can only be interviewed under caution if there's fresh evidence, and there wasn't any. The double jeopardy law and things, you know, was all changing, whatever. But I mean, what is the point anyway? Because he'd done more than his time. I don't know. There was no point in doing it. The whole point of cooperating was to try and find out who really killed Wendy Sewell, not necessarily to look at that. And all they did was to try and revisit some of the evidence that was used in the build up to the appeal.
Yeah, and Tony suggested that they'd used the lines of inquiries that you'd identified as kind of roots into it, really.
Yeah, but these weren't, they classed them as suspects. like 22 suspects or whatever. I mean, there were never suspects. Out of that, there were probably only two potential suspects on it. And they, well, one's never been interviewed to my knowledge to this day. And the other one, we proved quite comprehensively that he'd lied about his alibi. So to me, he was a prime suspect and a former boyfriend of the victim. So that's your starting point. The other people were purely witnesses, persons of interest who may have seen something or helped to contribute in terms of confirming Wendy's journey. There's no way you could consider them as suspects, but the police, in their wisdom, turned everybody as a suspect and then tried to eliminate them. So it's quite easy to build up and say, oh, we've got 22 suspects, but we've eliminated all of them now. They weren't suspects in the first place.
Because there seemed to be quite a... Just looking at some of the newspaper clippings and things from that time, so there's a combative air about things. Was there an article in the Times and Telegraph? There's some quite critical pieces written about your methods and the work that you'd done.
Yeah, these were... Basically, the police gave them... statements and stuff about it. Their intention was to try and trash my evidence. Lots of things they came up with, little tickle-tackle things. But again, it was the same emphasis that I'd failed to identify the real killer and things, which wasn't ever my intention.
Good job.
You know, my intention was, purely and simply, to prove that there was doubt against Downing's conviction, take it to an appeal and to get the conviction quashed. Job done. That's what I did.
So why do you think, I just want to stick with the reinvestigation thing, because it seemed like there was a suggestion that there were holes that you'd left bits out on purpose.
Nothing was left out. I mean, they had access to everything I put forward. Everything went through to the
Or in your commission. Appeal, in the submission that you left bits out to create a certain picture.
Well, if they tell me what bits are left out, I could tell you, but honestly, there was nothing left out. I had access on several occasions to everything. I tried to copy them in. That was probably a mistake because it gave them the heads up in terms of what I was going to say.
Oh, but when you were putting together the submission, you copied the police?
Yeah, yeah.
That seems fair.
So they had everything. The Home Office had everything and the CCRC had everything. So I don't see... And obviously, when they came, they did this reinvestigation, I gave them access to all my files and everything else. They've never said to me, there's nothing you've not shown us or anything like that. They had tapes, they had interview notes, they had the whole lot. They twisted and manipulated things around as they often do.
Yeah, because there was a suggestion, just look at my notes, that you'd embellished or changed people's testimony.
No.
What's your response?
No, I mean, quite a lot of things were recorded. You know, I gave them copies of these.
Of tape recorded?
Of tapes, yeah. They had transcripts, they had tapes, they had... what have you? And they were claiming sometimes that people hadn't been interviewed by me, when I've got copies of all the interviews and tapes and things like
that. Right, that's going to be saying yes.
So I was more than happy. You know, it wouldn't be my interest to withhold anything. If I thought somebody was saying something slightly different to what we thought originally, it would be my interest to give them that information. But I keep saying the way it's been manipulated by the police is that as if I was on the trail of the killer.
And they said they just basically got a copy of your book out of the library and
tried to trash it.
Yeah.
Some people had doubts too about the intimidation and the attacks that Don had reported.
Some of the stuff in Don's book were, I don't know, we were never able to substantiate some of the claims that had been made. And actually there were some people that suggested what Don had said didn't actually take place.
Is this about the attacks on him?
Yes, there was something around the attacks. So there was being run off the road and da-da-da and all that kind of stuff. We were never able to substantiate that. There was no damage to any fields. We were able to work out from how he described it, where it had happened. You know, whether it had happened somewhere else and he got confused, I don't know. But we felt that it hadn't happened there. There was the attack on the newspaper officers. That was never reported to the police. You know, there was no records of that happening. Well, there was no records of it happening, whether it was reported or not is another issue. So there's a few things in there that we were unable to say definitively they had happened.
And one of the things, you know, while we're on people slinging mud at you, and you know, it's not the first time I'm bringing these things up with you, there have been, you know, various people writing things that they think that the attacks on your life and the threats is made up, that you've bound to see that it's not, didn't happen.
Well, what can you say? You
particularly
know,
the lorry chase.
Well, how can you prove it when you're on your own on a deserted road at the middle of the night and suddenly a lorry starts chasing and banging into and etc. I mean, if my dog was still here, he would probably tell you. But there's nobody else. They're not interested. They don't want to take any of this on board, you know. So I don't see what more I could have done.
In the end, who knows? It's one version of a story against another. Many raise a questioning eyebrow over these dramatic stories. Don believes they happened, and Jackie, who works with him, sees no reason to doubt.
Yeah, I mean, he said that people had threatened him, and I believed him. He genuinely seemed quite shocked when he came in after, you know.
I spoke to Wendy's husband, David Saul, at length on the phone, and he didn't want to revisit his wife's brutal murder. He is still very angry. He told me he'd found the reinvestigation very unsettling for the whole family, and for Wendy's mother in particular.
It's very difficult for her husband and her family and her mother, who continued to live in Bakewell for a long, long time after Wendy was murdered.
And her mother was still alive when you were researching?
Her mother was. I didn't meet her. I tried to meet her. She didn't want to discuss it. But I did know people who knew her, and I knew that she was an old lady then. I knew that she was upset and confused by what had happened. I mean, on the one hand, you know, your daughter's murdered in the most incredibly savage way. And then later on, an account of the murder emerges, which appears to damn her daughter for sort of, in effect, bringing it on herself.
In the course of Operation Noble, the police spoke to over 1,500 people and interviewed 22 persons of interest. The only person they didn't speak to was Stephen. And at the end, this was the conclusion they reached.
The police are not looking for any other person for the murder of Wendy Sewell, a young woman in the prime of her life who was robbed of her future as a result of this vicious attack. All possible lines of inquiry have been exhausted. The case is now closed unless any substantial new evidence comes to light.
Yeah. Do you think everyone wished he hadn't taken it up?
I don't know, really. I mean, I suppose, in a way, it's led him to have a career looking at miscarriages of justice and doing other research and things. So I suppose it led him to do quite a lot of... And he's been involved in lots of other cases since, hasn't he?
Yeah, So it opened a door.
Yeah.
Just fast-forwarding to now, I mean, are you going to continue with the miscarriages of justice or is it time to take
it? No. No, I finished. I didn't want to do the other three, never mind the first one, really. But no, I mean, I wanted a quieter life. I mean, I've enjoyed, in a sense, working with the team from HarperCollins on this one. And you can buy the book, you can listen to the podcast. This is what people have not heard before, really, the true story of what it's like to be involved with something like this. And it's a fascinating, scintillating, dangerous sort of roller coaster ride.
Was it worth it?
Well, it's worth it to see, you know, people like Stephen particularly out. He was able to get out and have maybe, 10 years or something with his parents before the past. You know, that was very precious because I think if he's still in jail now and his parents had passed away, there's nothing to come out for, really.
So what is the legacy of this case, of the brutal murder of Wendy Sewell?
The taste in my mouth still is that Wendy was re-victimised, her memory was re-victimised, and continues to be re-victimised by this, every two or three years, something else comes out. But
when you didn't know her?
No.
But from all the people you've spoken to, what picture of the woman, not the victim, do you get?
Well, she's always described as an attractive brunette in a typical lurid, sexist way. That's my view. And I guess she was a normal girl with a marriage and people have marriages and partnerships have their ups and downs, as we all do, and I guess they did. And then because of her alleged adultery, then all of a sudden she becomes, oh, well, that's okay for her to be a victim then. Mm-hmm. Now I just think any town, anywhere, any time, there are Wendy Sewells, and she's no different from me, you, anybody, I don't know you, but anybody.
Yeah, no, what I bring that up is because when I'm reading, and I've been speaking to some people, I'm reading stuff about her, so I get this impression of her as being a very bright, yes, attractive, yep, creative, yes, funny.
Popular. Everybody I spoke to, Ray Downing included. No natural enemies, didn't appear to have, and was a figure around town who everybody knew.
And she moved in from Sheffield rather, yep, than being born and bred.
That's right.
Being bright and outgoing. I figured she must have kind of stood out in, yeah, a really...
Well, probably city girl come to the hills, you know, to the sticks. And that's not in any derogatory, no, sense. That day when she left her office to go to look at headstones for her father's, like a recent bereavement of her father, for ideas, proved to be a downfall.
You think he was just in the wrong place at the wrong time?
Well,
or was it more a target?
It's a very loaded question.
Okay.
I have a theory which I can't say on here, but...
Okay,
you
don't have the record.
Yeah.
I don't think the impact either of the crime or of the conviction or of the release has had a terrific impact on Bakewell. I'm Matthew Paris, a Times columnist.
Matthew was also the former MP for West Derbyshire, which includes Bakewell.
But it has had, in a subtle way, I think, an effect on the town. The town was not entirely kindly portrayed, and the sheer horror of the scene of her murder has become a little bit associated, not with Bakewell and Bakewell people, but it's something that people who were there at the time don't forget. I drive past every time I go into Bakewell, and I've never especially wanted to get out and walk around, and I don't think anyone who was in Bakewell at the time will ever do other than associate that scene, that patch of churchyard, with the awful murder. Place gets indelibly associations, and it's that's a very sad and persisting one.
There seems to be a kind of, you know, sort of division of opinion even now about Don Hale when I've been visiting. And people kind of, some people are like, there's still feeling of like he shouldn't have stirred up trouble.
There were plenty of people in Bakewell who, whatever the arguments of process about his conviction, remained pretty sure that he had been the murderer, and there still are. And of course, people like that will feel uncomfortable about him. One can't avoid that. There is a sub-theme to this story which perhaps hasn't been given the attention that it deserves. People who are mentally fit to plead, which he certainly was, he's not a moron or anything like that, but are just a little bit, we used to say remedial, and I don't know what we say now. How the law and how the police treat such people is a very tricky and sensitive matter, and plainly the Bakewell police didn't get that right, and I bet that isn't the only case where the police aren't getting this quite right. And I don't blame the police. Someone is either fit to plead or they aren't, I suppose. But you do need special training and special sensitivity when you're dealing with someone who isn't a particularly bright spark.
I was surprised to find a real living legacy in Derby University. The mistakes in the investigation of Wendy's murder and the behaviour of the police, which resulted in Stephen Downing serving 27 years in prison, are being used by the university in order to train police how to police well and correctly, as a cold case to investigate and learn techniques and learn what not to do. Tony Blockley is the head of the course.
Stephen's case is done and dusted, yes, if you like.
Yes, got, yeah.
You know. They can work on current cases. We use it as a case study. So what we've done normally is we've given a presentation, and I've given a presentation, or somebody else has given a presentation on Stephen's case, you know, about the investigation, about the flaws in the investigation, about the conviction, about then the subsequent and consequential actions of that, you know, around unsafe conviction, et cetera, et cetera. But I think what we're going to do next year, because I think it does generate a lot of interest and a lot of discussion, is we're going to actually get our students to analyse the case and present it back to us.
And the students on the course have been instrumental in identifying problems with cases of Britons who have died abroad and getting the police investigations where the students have identified problems in the case reopened.
Recently, we have started doing work with cases abroad, murdered abroad, and that's had elements of success to it. You know, we've got a current case that we're still waiting for the outcome on, which was a young lady called Claire Martin. And I produced on the basis of the work we'd done, an expert report in terms of what we thought. She was originally said she committed suicide. We said she hasn't.
Was that abroad?
Yeah, in Italy. We've said, no, she hasn't committed suicide. There are some failings in the investigation, but actually the evidence that we have would suggest she was murdered. There was some significant evidence that we uncovered which hadn't been uncovered.
And this
is
you and your students, your students part of your team. Yeah. That's fascinating.
Yeah, and actually now we're just waiting for it to hopefully be reopened as a murder investigation in Italy. And bearing in mind, these are going to be lawyers or police officers or within the criminal justice system.
That's interesting. So Stephen Downing's case, which was used as a kind of criticism of a bad practice, now it's now being used to educate good practice.
Yeah, absolutely. I've not actually thought about it like that. You know, that's interesting that we have turned this sort of negative image of what happened into a positive learning experience. So.
And not just for, you know, analysis, but actually people are going to go out and do it. That's what interests me.
So, in a way, in an oblique way, Wendy's murder has at least been useful in getting some justice and resolution for other grieving families. It's not much, but it's something, I suppose.
In some senses, when something like this happens, and I think when you do reflect on it, you think there weren't any winners here at all, and that ultimately this was something that was played out on the national level and in the national media, but ultimately it's just a very sad personal human tale here that, you know, ultimately Wendy's family lost someone who was loved and was very dear to them.
It doesn't take away from the brutality of the attack on Wendy Saul on that sunny September afternoon in the graveyard in 1973. The attack that robbed her of the life that she might have led and denied her a future. There are no victors in this story. Reporter, Murder in the Graveyard was presented and produced by me, Lucy Ditchmont. It was mixed by Dave Dodd. The music was composed and performed by Edwin Pearson. The executive producer was Matt Horn. Reporter, Murder in the Graveyard was a Wireless Studios production. And you can listen to Reporter, Murder in the Graveyard on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever you get your podcasts from. And please feel free to rate and review.
William Tyrrell was a three-year-old boy who disappeared from the township of Kendal on the New South Wales mid-north coast on 12 September 2014. Police have been told he was outside playing 1 minute and gone the next. His disappearance has become one of the most puzzling investigations in Australian history. It has been going on now for almost 5 years. Millions of dollars have been spent. The strike force at one point had 26 full-time detectives. Hundreds more around Australia have been exploring 600 possible suspects. And what has all that been for? William is still missing. My name is Caroline Overington. This investigation, Nowhere Child, is available now. To hear more, just search for Nowhere Child in your podcast app.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.